down the hall from my big empire, there was a little office. It had been a closet. And they needed an extra office, so they cleared out the closet and they put a desk in there. And in that was Timothy Leary. And he had been bicycling around India, bouncing checks, and they had found him and brought him back as a creative gift to Western science. And Tim and I started to become drinking buddies together. And we started to teach courses together. We were teaching the first year clinical course of practicum on existential transactional behavior change. And the more time I spent with Tim, the more I realized that he had an absolutely extraordinary intellect. He really knew a lot. And I found him extremely stimulating, and the students found him extraordinarily exciting to be around just because of his openness to new ideas and his willingness to take wild risk in thinking. And one night when we were drinking together, we plotted a trip across the north of South America, and I said that I flew, and he said, great, we'll fly a little plane across South America, and I said, wonderful. And I had neglected to tell him that all I had was a student license. So I then secretly set about getting a license in order to be able to meet him on August 1st in Cuernavaca in Mexico to start our journey, where he was summering. And I was a consultant at that time for a school mathematics study group and a mathematics program in education. And I was out at Stanford, and I got my license and got my airplane and flew to Mexico in a death-defying leap. And when I got there, Timothy had done some other types of flying just about the week before. Frank Barron, the psychologist at Cal, an old friend of him, had introduced him to an anthropologist in Mexico, and they had come to know about Tiahuanaco, the flesh of the god, the magic mushrooms in Mexico, which one obtained from Crazy Juana, a woman up in the mountains who was known as Crazy, who kept eating her own product all the time. And contact was made with her, and the mushrooms were obtained. He had ingested 9 of these mushrooms, so many male and so many female mushrooms, with a group of others around the swimming pool. And the experience he had, he said, quote, I learned more in the 6 or 7 hours of this experience than I had learned in all my years as a psychologist, which is a strong statement. When I arrived there, the mushrooms were all gone. And so was the zeal to go on a trip across South America, because what was the sense in doing external journeying when obviously what Timothy had been looking for was inside his own head? So I hung out in Tepoztlan with Dave McCullen and his family, and in Cuernavaca with Tim and his entourage, and then flew back to the United States with Tim and Jackie, his son, and an iguana. And I went to be a visiting professor at Cal, and Tim went back to Harvard. And by the time I got back, Timothy had a large project going. He had consulted with Aldous Huxley, who was then visiting at MIT, and Aldous and Tim and a number of graduate students had contacted Sandoz, who produced a synthetic of the magic mushrooms called psilocybin, and they had gotten a test batch of this, and they were busy taking it and administering it. And so when I got back in the spring, I was invited to share in this bounty. And the night that was chosen turned out to be the night of the biggest snowstorm of the year, and it was to be at Tim's home. And I plowed through the snow. It was a few blocks from the home of my parents, where I had been visiting for dinner in Newton. And I plowed through the snow, and I came in, and we sat around the kitchen table, and there were about 3 or 4 of us. And we passed the bottle pills around and took them, and that was my preparation and my setting. But the fact was that I trusted Timothy, and I had seen that Timothy had had a profound experience, and he was somebody whose intellect I understood, and I knew that he was not interpersonally destructive. I mean, he might be destructive of institutions, but not of individuals. He was a very loving person. We took a very small dosage. I think we probably took about 10 milligrams, about 5 of these little 2 milligram pills each. And the first part of the experience was what would be sort of like a strong pot high, I'd say. A little more dramatic, a little more intense, and clearly something happened. I had started smoking marijuana back in 1954, I guess, when one of my therapy patients turned me on. I would get in this peculiar predicament that I would be doing therapy with somebody, and I would sense that they were getting more out of the drama of life than I was. And I was the healthy one, and they were the sick one. And they weren't making it, and I was teaching them, but they somehow knew something I didn't know. And finally, they took pity on me, I guess, and they turned on the shrink. And I became, at Stanford, a sort of therapist for the hippie community called Perry Lane. But most of that had just been sort of intensifications of sensory input, colors, sounds. You know, you'd listen to Miles Davis play the trumpet. You'd be right in the middle of the trumpet. It would be the most awesome trumpet sound you'd ever heard. Well, the first part of this experience at psilocybin, we got into kind of a very low-level tragic comedy type thing. The dog had been out running in the snow and came in and was panting. And to our timeless mind, it seemed like the dog was dying. It was panting too long. And we sat around at midnight on Saturday night in the biggest snow when all transportation was stopped, figuring out what to do about this dying dog. None of us, however, really knowing that the dog was dying, because we understood that we were under the influence of something or other that had altered our consciousness. And after a long deliberation in which we felt that we were holding the dog and the dog was near the end, we called down Timothy Sun, who was 11 years old, who was looking at television upstairs. He came down and whose dog it was, and when he walked in, the dog jumped up and played with him, and that was the end of that drum. And I, who had led the emotional drama of carrying the dog to the vet through the snow 4 miles, sheepishly went off into the living room and sat down in the semi-darkness and just felt I wanted to be alone, away from so much stimulation externally. And then I experienced the following. I sat in the semi-darkness on the couch and I saw across the room about 8 feet away from me a being standing there. And I thought I was alone in the room and I strained to see who it was, and it turned out to be me, which took me back a bit. And it was me, strangely, because I had only worn it maybe twice, in cap and gown. It was, in a sense, professor-ness. And I looked at it, and I said to myself, a dissociative experience. I'm having a hallucination. And I got the anxiety of there was professor-ness, and here was I. And I thought, well, apparently, that's over there and I'm here. And though I worked very hard to get that, I can give it up. So at that point, I just sort of said, all right, and I let go of that. And the minute I did that, the image changed. And there was somebody else standing there, and I strained to see. And again, it was me. And this time it was me in another role, that of violoncellist. Which I was a very mediocre one, which wasn't hard to give up since I wasn't very good at it anyway. And then slowly, each of my roles, each of my social roles became manifest. They were about 8 feet away from me. And I was sitting on this couch watching role after role fall away. All of my attitudinal roles, cute, knowledgeable, intellectual, sharp, lovable, lover, pilot, you know, daredevil, all the different images were manifested in some physical form, and they were over there, and each one I said, okay, that can go too. And then what I saw over there was Richard Alpert-ness. Say, is that behind all of the external or the more superficial social role, there is a social role that is attached to your name of, come here, Richard, go to bed, Richard, it's time, put on a sweater, you know, the whole thing you learn way, way, way back when you develop a basic core self-image, if you will. And then I started to get quite anxious because what it meant, and I thought to myself, if I recall, what has this madman Larry done to me? I'm going to have amnesia. I'm going to forget who I am. I won't know who I am. And I went through quite a few changes about that, and then I thought, all right, so I'll give up my identity. I'll give that up because, after all, I can always get another identity. And that's how I thought, at least I have my body. But I, of course, had spoken too soon, as some of you who have explored in this way know, because I looked down and there was nothing below my kneecaps. And then to my horror, progressively, with my eyes open, I saw my body disappear. Until I looked down and all there was a couch. Now, my model as a social scientist had nothing in it that allowed for this possibility. When your body went, you went. That was it. There's nothing more after that. So I really panicked. I thought I've gone too far now. Up until then, it was cute. But this is known as a bad trip. We didn't have that label in those days, but that's roughly now what we call it. And I panicked, and I wanted out, and I was about to scream, and I felt the adrenaline pump through me, and I remember the sweat and the agitation. Although there was no body, these were inner experiences, although my eyes were open, and there was no body to see. And right in the midst of all that panic, just as I was about to yell to Tim to come and save me from dying, there was a little voice inside that said, seems to me rather jocularly, considering the gravity of the situation, but who's minding the store? And with that voice, it was as if I established a contact with a place in myself, which was that voice, which was, what would I call it? At the time, I called it a scanning device. I called it pure awareness. I called it the eye behind all the rest of it. But it was clear that there was a place in me that was independent of my body and my personality and all those things which had all fallen away bit by bit by bit by bit. Even though this was all hallucination, still there was a place back inside me where I was. And the minute I sensed that, I became extraordinarily calm and a deep feeling of well-being came over me. In fact, such a profound feeling of well-being. It was a feeling that I almost could not recall having ever experienced before, except at moments of extraordinarily high achievement. When I would get one moment of that, or sexual moments, an orgasm, when it'd be that feeling of well-being, that moment. And here was one of those places, except it just was a place inside me. And it was as if, as later I tried to think about it, as if I had been up until that moment what Dave Reese would call another directed person. I had been so trained, that was how I got all my brownie points, to know what everybody wanted me to be, that I was being it all. I had never listened to that place inside. And now, for the first time, there was a place inside. I had shredded away enough stuff to hear someplace inside myself. And I got very excited, and I ran out into the snow, and I danced around. And I remember the house disappeared in the snow, and I, instead of being worried about this, I thought, it's all right, because I am. Feeling I am. And by then, it was late in the night, and around 5 in the morning, I walked back through the snow, plowing through the snow, and I got to my parents' home, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be a nice thing? I'll shovel a walk. Young tribal buck shovels a walk. And so I started shovel a walk, and my parents' faces appeared at the upstairs window. Come to bed, you idiot. Nobody shovels snow at 5 in the morning. And I looked up at them, and I heard it. That is the external voice I had been listening to for 30 years. And inside me, something said, it's all right to shovel snow, and it's all right to be happy. It's very quiet, and it's a very beautiful shoveling snow, and I'm very happy. And I looked up at them, and I laughed, and I did a jig. I went back to shoveling snow, and they closed the window, and then I looked up, and inside they were smiling, too. But also, you can see in that the seeds of the breakaway, the seeds of the ability to be able to confront an existing institution and know inside it's all right and trust that place inside. It's something I could never have done until that moment, until that day. I could never have done it. Now, I thought at that moment, wow, I've got it made. I'm this new beautiful being. I'm just an inner self. All I ever need to do is look inside, and I'll know what to do, and I can always trust it. And here I will be forever. And 2 or 3 days later, I was talking about the whole thing in the past tense. And then I was talking about how I experienced this thing. Because 2 or 3 days later, I was back being an anxiety neurotic. A milder, slightly milder, but still, it was sneaking back up on me. Well, now you can't have an experience like that and then turn your back on it. You just can't do that. And that's what the problem was we all face, you see. Because what would happen is, you would have one of these experiences, and then you would want to share it with all your colleagues. So you'd go into the lunchroom, and you'd say, I just had this experience, and you get to a certain point, and then you couldn't explain anymore, because I was even teaching psychology out of a current social psychology text that said, man is the sum of his social roles. And I suddenly saw most of what I was teaching was not valid enough. And I get to a point with my colleagues, and I couldn't explain any further, because it came down to, he who has had the experience, no explanation is necessary, so he who hasn't done is possible. And we would feel this frustration when they'd say, it sounds very interesting, and we'd say, well, look, in order to know, you've really got to try it. And they'd say, that isn't scientific, it isn't appropriate to, you know, test your own products. And we were exploring this inner realm of consciousness that we had been theorizing about all these years, and suddenly it was like you were traveling in and through and around it. So by the second week, you know, 5 or 6 of us, when we were hanging out together, they said, aha, cult is forming, which in truth was forming. Now, Tim's model about how to work with this stuff was the following. He said, we don't know what this is about yet, and there are many models, but it would be best not to impose a model too soon, because the model that exists in the West for these states is pathological. And the model that lives in primitive cultures is mystical and religious, and better we keep wide open. So we did what would you call a naturalistic study, in which we gave the psilocybin to maybe 200 people who were physically healthy enough and so on. And we said, you take it under any conditions you want, and all you've got to do is answer this questionnaire at the end, so we'll know what happens. You do it how you want to do it. So we give it to jazz musicians and physicists and philosophers and ministers and junkies and graduate students and social scientists even. And at the end we had these 200 protocols, and the first analysis we did showed us very clearly that the reactions were a function of set and setting. The reactions that people had were a function of their expectations of what was going to happen and the environment in which they had it. And they're expecting to have excitement, they tended to have paranoid excitement. All it did was seem to intensify one's expectations. However, the data also showed something else, that out of these first 200, you could see that there was some kind of a stepladder of experiences. There was a kind of a probabilistic hierarchy of experience, so that the most likely experience everybody had was a heightened sensitivity to all of their 5 senses, speeding up the thought process. Then the next type of experience that people would more frequently report was an interpersonal shift of figure and ground, where they would look at another person and they would see the way in which you and I are similar rather than which we're different. And it was as if the whole Western mind training of individual differences had been made background instead of figure. So that you'd look at another human being and you'd see, here we are, and you'd see differences more as clothing rather than as core. So, this was a critical thing. For example, we had a Negro psychiatrist, Madison Presnell, working with us, and I had been trained to be a very liberal person about Negroes, which meant that you didn't have feelings. I mean, it was like a phony kind of a liberal thing. I mean, I went out of my way to be liberal, you know, that kind of very self-conscious type of equality. And Madison and I turned on together, and I looked at Madison, and there was Madison and I, and we were the same human beings. It was just that he was wearing that skin, and I was wearing this skin. And it was no more or less than that. It was that shirt and this shirt, and it had no more relevance than that. And I looked at that, And suddenly, there Madison and I were, and I had for the first time made that kind of a content. Because I had been so busy reacting to color of skin with my super liberal thing that I couldn't relax enough to share this unitive place. Then there was a still less frequent report of people who experienced a oneness, which they would say, like I remember being in a dark room with another person, and one of us spoke, and somebody said, who spoke, you or me? In other words, it wasn't clear whose mouth it came out of. And then there was an experience where you looked at somebody and you started to see them as patterns of energy. And then you started to see cellular structure and so on. And as you kept going, you got to the tiniest frequency, which was maybe 3% or something like that, of people who saw it all as just pure energy, as a homogeneous field, which has been called the white light. There is that frequency of occurrence, and I have been riding up and down this scale in these experiences. And I started to go on with the group to experiment, and there was research going on by the group in prisons to try to change the recidivism rate of prisoners. A study was run by Walter Pankey and a group of the research community on Good Friday in Boston University Chapel with 10 advanced minister trained students under psilocybin and 10 with a placebo in a double-blind study. Very far out thing, you know, running a double-blind study on Good Friday and in a chapel with the ministers who took the psilocybin. It was absurd, because the double-blind study was absurd, because everybody knew something was happening. It was as if you were proving the obvious, because somebody who had taken something that made their skin crawl said, well, maybe something's happening, and then somebody would stagger in the room and say, I see God, I see God, and that was obvious who would have the drug within about 5 minutes. Now, my own experiences were horrible and beautiful, and I kept working in different environments and settings, and pretty much anybody that I trusted that brought along some new chemical, I would open my mouth and off I'd go, because I was doing this exploring. For example, at one point I had been in the meditation room in the house we had in Newton, this community we had in Newton. And I was for 4 hours in a state of total homogeneous light bliss. And then I recall starting to, quote, come down, and this huge red wave rolled in across the room. It looked like a cross between a William Blake picture of the wave and a Hieronymus Bosch painting. And it was all my identity that was rolling in over me. And I remember holding up my hand saying, no, no, I don't want to go back, you know, because it was like this heavy burden I was going to take on myself. And I didn't know the key. I realized I didn't know the magic word, like abracadabra or hocus pocus or whatever it was going to be, that would stop that wave. And it rolled in over me, and then I, oh, here I am again. Yeah. Richard Alpert. Wow, what a drag. So what had happened was, in these few years, we had gone through first feeling like one experience is going to make you enlightened forever, and then realizing that it wasn't going to be that simple. And for 5 years, I dealt with the matter of, quote, coming down, about coming down. And the coming down matter was what led me to the next chapter of this drama. Because after 6 years, I realized that no matter how ingenious my experimental designs were and how high I got, and at one point I took 5 people and we locked ourselves in a building for 3 weeks, and we took 400 micrograms of LSD every 4 hours, which is 2,200 micrograms of LSD a day, which sounds fancy, but after your first dose, you build a tolerance as a refractory period. That sounds technical. We finally just drink it out of the bottle. I mean, because it didn't seem to matter anymore. And we just stayed at a plateau. We were very high at what happened in those 3 weeks in that house. No one would ever believe, including us. And at the end of the 3 weeks, we walked out of the house, and within a few days, we came down. And it was this terribly frustrating experience. Now I understand that Christ's parable of the wedding guest is very appropriate. The king invites many people to the wedding feast, and most of them are too busy with worldly concerns to come. And finally, he invites people off the street. And there's somebody that comes in that is not wearing a wedding garment. And he says, why are you not wearing a wedding garment? And the person is speechless. And the king has his servants bind the person hand and foot and cast them into outer darkness. and there was much crying of gnashing of teeth. Well, that was the experience we were having. It was as if you came into the kingdom of heaven, and you saw how it all was, and you felt these new states of awareness, and then you get passed out again. And you began, after 200-300 times of this, you began to feel an extraordinary kind of depression set in, a very gentle depression, that whatever you knew wasn't enough. Now, at the same moment, there were obvious changes going on, because that checking back over and over again to that inner place inside myself made me less and less attached to reassurance from the environment that I was all right. I remember at the moment when I'd been thrown out of Harvard, and there was a press conference, and all of the reporters looked at me as if I was like a prize fighter who had just lost a major fight which was going to make me go into oblivion. That kind of look you have for losers. I mean, real losers. And they stood there looking at me that way. It was, everybody was looking at me that way. And inside, I felt what I'm doing is all right. And I thought, everybody, my parents were sitting Shiva. I mean, it was a horrible thing. And all I felt inside was, I must really be crazy. Because craziness is where everybody agrees you are crazy, except you. So I knew this was a new kind of craziness. Oh, this was real craziness, right? But the thing was that I always seemed to be able to skirt the line. I didn't do anything crazy enough. I was the guy that people would come and say, look, would you calm Tim Leary down? He's like a complete madman. If you'll calm him and protect him, then, you know, and I'd say, I'll protect him because he's that great a being. I'd go raise money and run the kitchen and clean the house and, you know. Well, we realized that what we needed to do was to create certain kinds of environments which would allow a person, after being into another state of consciousness, to retain a certain kind of environmental support for new ways of looking at oneself. If you see yourself as God, and then you come back from this room and somebody says, hey, Sam, empty the garbage, it catches you back in a model of I'm Sam who empties the garbage, you see, and like you can't maintain these new kinds of structures. Now, by 1967, I'm in the following predicament. I am aware that I don't know enough to maintain these states of consciousness. The second thing is, I am aware that nobody else knows enough either around me. And everybody I thought might know, I check with, and nobody seemed to know. Now, in 1962 or 3, we had rather Tim, and then Ralph with him, and I was just put on the title because I took care of the kitchen. Had come across the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was a very close description of a number of these experiences. And this was a book that was 2,500 years old, at least, and that had been used for preparing Tibetan lamas to die and be reincarnated. And when we opened it, we would find descriptions of the 49 days after death before rebirth that looked like the session we had last Tuesday night. And how could this be? I mean, the parallel was so close. And so Tim rewrote the book as a manual called The Psychedelic Experience, a manual for psychological death and rebirth, arguing that this was really a metaphor about psychological death and rebirth, not necessarily physical death and reincarnation. Tim had gone to India. Ralph had gone to India. Allen Ginsberg had gone to India. I had checked with everybody, and when they came back, I realized that they had all had lovely experiences and seeing a beautiful country and so on, but the thing they were looking for, they couldn't find. So I wasn't very optimistic about the whole thing, but by 1967, I had shot my load, literally. I had no more job as a psychologist in a respectable establishment, and I realized that we didn't know enough about psychedelics to make it work. And at the time, I was lecturing around the country on psychedelics to as diverse groups as the Food and Drug Administration and the Hells Angels. At this point, along came a very lovely guy who I had guided through some psychedelics, who was an interesting guy. He had gone to the University of Chicago and helped to start or started a company, was president of a company called Basic Systems, which had been sold to Xerox. And now he had retired. He was about 35, and he had retired and taken his $5 million or whatever he made, and was now becoming a Buddhist or something. Buddhism. And he wanted to make a journey to the East to look for holy men, and he invited me to go along. And he had a Land Rover imported into Tehran, and this was my way out. And what else was I going to do at this point? So I left to go to India, and I took a bottle of LSD with me, with the idea that I'll meet holy men along the way, and I'll give them LSD, and they'll tell me what LSD is. Maybe I'll learn the clue that way. We started out from Tehran, and for the next 3 months, we had lovely guides, and we had a most beautiful time, and we scored great hashish in Afghanistan. And at the end of 3 months, I had seen the inside of the Land Rover. I had 1,300 slides, many tape recordings of Indian music, and much bottled water and canned goods. And I was a Westerner traveling in India. That's what was happening to me. And I got to Nepal, and we had done it all. And we had gone on horseback up to Amarnath Cave in Kashmir, which I didn't understand at all. I mean, it was a big cave, but there were some nice girls we had with us. We went to the dying, to Benares, Kashi. And finally, we ended up in Kathmandu, Nepal. And I started to get extremely, extremely depressed. I'm sure part of it was due to the hashish I was smoking. But also, part of it was because I didn't see what to do next. Everything I thought I could do wasn't working. And the despair got very great. We didn't know enough that I couldn't figure out how to socialize this thing about these new states of consciousness. And I didn't know what to do next. It wasn't like I didn't have any LSD. I had plenty of LSD, but why take it? Because I knew what it was going to do. I knew what it was going to tell me. It was going to show me that garden again, and then I was going to be cast out. And so that was it. And I never could quite stay. I was addicted to the experience at first, and then I even got tired of that. And the despair was extremely intense at that point. And we were sitting in a hippie restaurant called the Blue Tibetan. And I was talking to some French hippies. And I had given LSD to a number of pundits around India and some reasonably pure men. And an old Buddhist lama said it gave me a headache. Somebody else said, it's good but not as good as meditation. Somebody else said, where can I get some more? And I got the same range of responses I get in America. I didn't get any great key of wisdom like, oh, that's what that, you know, I was waiting for something that was going to do that thing. So I finally figured, well, it's not going to happen. And we were about to go into Japan, and I was pretty depressed because then we were starting to return now. And what was I coming returning to? What should I do now? And I had decided I was going to come back and I was going to become a shelter. Because I wanted to be a servant, I decided then somebody else will program my consciousness, and I can read holy books while I'm waiting for whoever it is I'm waiting for. I can just get out of the whole drama of having to engineer my own ship, which is a funny foreshadowing, as you'll see. And the despair was extremely intense at that point. I was really quite sad. I was in the Blue Tibetan with my friend and these other people, and in walked this guy, and he was very extraordinary, mainly for his height. He was 6'7", and he had long blonde hair and long blonde beard. He was a Westerner, American, and wearing holy clothes, dhoti, beads. And he came directly over to our table and sat down, and it was a crowded and it was all right. Now, up until then, I had found this interesting thing that I don't think I could have labeled until that moment, that except for once, when I had met Geshe Wangyal at Freehold, New Jersey, the Lama at Tibetan Lama at Freehold, whom when I met, I knew I was meeting a being that knew, but I couldn't get to it because I wasn't ready somehow to hear. We were very close. We loved each other extraordinarily, but I hadn't been able to really absorb whatever I needed to absorb. And here was this guy again, where I met somebody who knew. I don't know how to describe this to you, except that I was in the predicament through game after game after game, first being a professor at Harvard and then being a psychedelic spokesman, that people were constantly looking into my eyes like, do you know? It's just that subtle little look, you know. And I was constantly looking into their eyes, do you know? And there we were, you know, do you? No, do you? No, do you? Maybe he. And there was always that feeling that everybody was very close, and we all knew we knew, but nobody quite knew. I don't know how to describe it other than that. And I met this guy, and there was no doubt in my mind. It was just like meeting a rock. It was just solid all the way through. Everywhere I pressed, there he was. So we spirited him back. We were staying at, of course, the hotel owned by the king or the prince or something, because we were going first class. We spirited him up to our suite in the Sewalti Hotel. And for 5 days, we had a continuing seminar. We had this extraordinarily beautiful Indian sculptor, Harish Johari, who was our guide and friend. And Harish and this fellow, Bhagwan Das, and David and I sat there, and for 5 days on peach melbas and hashish and so on, we had a seminar with Alexander David Neal's books and Arthur Avedon and Sir John Woodruff and so on. At the end of 5 days, I was still absolutely staggered by this guy. And he had started to teach me some mantras and working with beads, and which I'll describe. And so when it came time to leave, to go to Japan, I had the choice of going on to Japan on my first class route or going off with this guy back into India on a temple pilgrimage, and he had no money and I had no money, and like was going to change my style of life considerably. And I decided, well, look, I came to India to find something, and I still think this guy knows I'm going to follow him. And I thought, how absurd. Who's writing this script? That here I am, I've come halfway around the world, and I'm going to follow through India a 23-year-old guy from Laguna Beach, California. I mean, you know, it just doesn't... It's so bizarre a script. And I said to Harish and to David, do you think I'm making a mistake? And Harish said, no, he is a very high guy. And so I started to follow him and literally follow him. I mean, we'd walk through the streets. Now I'm suddenly barefoot because he says, you gotta wear shoes on, you know, it's that kind of thing. And a shoulder bag and a dhoti and my, I got blisters on my feet and dysentery, the likes of which you can't imagine. And all he says is, well, fast for a few days. He's very compassionate, but no pity. And we're sleeping on the ground or on these wooden tables that you get when you stop at monasteries. And we start to travel through temples, through Banashwar and Kanarak and so on. And he's starting to train me in the most interesting way. He's so powerful, so extraordinarily powerful. He's got an ektara, a one-stringed instrument, and I've got a little Tibetan drum. And we go around the villages, and people rush out because we're holy men, and this they touch our feet, which embarrasses me because I'm not a holy man. I'm obviously who I am. I'm a sort of an overage hippie, Western explorer, kind of, you know, and I feel very embarrassed when they do that, and they give us food, and he's giving away all my money. But I'm clinging tight to my passport and my return ticket to America, and a traveler's check that I'll need to get me to Delhi. I mean, those things I'm going to hold on to. And my bottle of LSD, in case I should find some interest. And I go through this extraordinary physical breakdown. And what will happen is I'll say to him, we'd be sitting somewhere, and I'd say, did I ever tell you about the time that Tim and I, and he'd say, don't think about the past. Be here now. Okay. He's silent, and I'd say, how long do you think we're going to be on this trip? And he'd say, don't care about the future. Just be here now. You know, I really feel crummy. My hips are hurting. Emotions are like waves. Watch them disappear into the distance on the vast, calm ocean. You just sort of wiped out my whole game. So that was it. That was my whole trip. Emotions, past, and future. Great storytelling. So we were silent. There was nothing to say. He'd say, you eat this. Or, now you sleep here. And all the rest of the time, we sang holy songs. That was all there was to do. Or he'd teach me an asana, a hatha yoga. But there was no conversation. I didn't know anything about his life. He didn't know anything about my life. He wasn't the least bit interested in all of the extraordinary dramas that I had collected. He was the first person I could seduce into being interested in all of this. He just didn't care. And yet I've never felt so profound an intimacy of being inside of me. And what started to blow my mind was that everywhere we went, if we went to a Theravadan Buddhist monastery, he would be walking and suddenly some piece of clothing he wore, suddenly I saw all the other monks wearing it, and I realized that he was an initiate in that scene, and they'd welcome him, and he'd be in the inner temple and the temple, and he knew all the chants, and he was doing those. We'd come across some Shaivites, some followers of Shiva, some of the Swamis and so on, and I suddenly realized that he was one of them, and suddenly on his forehead were the appropriate tilaks and the appropriate things, and suddenly he was doing their chanting. We would meet Kajipa Lamas from Tibet, and they would all welcome him as a brother, and he knew all their stuff. He had been in India for 5 years, and he was so high that everybody just welcomed him, like, you know, you're obviously one of us. And I couldn't figure out what his theme was, and all I felt was this tremendous pull toward Buddhism, because Hinduism always seemed a little gauche. The paintings were a little too, the colors were too bizarre, and the whole thing was too melodramatic and too much emotion, and, you know, and I was pulling toward that kind of clean, crystal clear simplicity of the Southern Buddhist or the Zen Buddhist. After about 3 months, I had a visa problem, and we went to Delhi, and I was still quite unsure of my new role as a holy man, and so when I got to Delhi, I took, out of my little traveler's check, I took $4, and I bought a pair of pants and a shirt and a tie, and I took my horn-rimmed glasses out of my shoulder bag, and I stuck them back on, and I became, again, Dr. Albert, to go to the visa office. Dr. Albert, who had a grant from the Folk Art Museum of New Mexico for collecting musical instruments, and I did my whole thing, you know, and I kept my beads in my pocket because I didn't feel valid in my other role. He had to have his annual visa worked over, and he had to go to a town nearby, which we went to, and we were welcomed at this big estate and given the holy man's house and food brought to us. And he said, you sit here. I'm going to see about my visa. He told me what to do. I mean, I was just like a baby. Eat this, sit here, do this. And I just gave up. I mean, he knew. Okay, you know, I'll follow you. He spoke Hindi fluently. My Hindi was very faltering. So he could handle it all very easily. We had spent a few weeks in a Chinese Buddhist monastery in the Sarnath, which was extraordinarily powerful and beautiful. Things were happening to me, but I couldn't grasp the total nature of the thing that was happening to me at all. Now, there was a strange thing about him at night. He didn't seem to sleep like I did. And sometimes I'd make believe I was asleep and then open sort of a half eye to see if wasn't he cheating, maybe he was sleeping now. And sometimes I'd see him lie down, but I would say that 80% of the time when I'd be sleeping heavily, he'd be sitting in something or other, which he'd never described to me. But he was not in personal contact. I mean, there was no, you know, you could wave and move around and nothing seemed to happen with him. That night I went out and the following event happened. Previous January at Boston, the Peter Ben Brigham Hospital, my mother had died. Her bone marrow stopped producing blood and her spleen took over and grew very large, and they removed it, and then she died in a long illness. And I had been with her through her dying process, and the whole thing had been extremely close, and we had come into contact. I spent days in the hospital room just meditating, and I felt when she died, I felt no loss. I felt a tremendous continuing contact with her. And in fact, when I had been in Nepal, I had had a vision of her. One night when I was going to bed, I saw her up in the ceiling, and I was wondering whether to go to India or go on to Japan, and she had a look that was the look of, you damn fool, you're always getting out of hot water, but go ahead, I think that's great. She looked peeved, pleased. It was like there were two beings in my mother. There was a middle-class woman from Boston, who wanted me to be absolutely responsible. And then there was this swinger underneath, this spiritual being underneath, and said, go, go, baby. You know? This night I'm under the skies, and I hadn't thought about her at all since that time. I'm under the stars going to the bathroom, and I look up, and the stars are very close because it's very dark in the town, and I suddenly experience the presence of Mother. And I think about her, and I'm not thinking about how she died or anything about it. I just feel her presence. It's very, very powerful. And I feel great love for her, and then I go back to bed. Of course, Bhagwan Das is not the least bit interested in any of my life, so he'd be the last person I'd tell about my dreams to or my visions. The next morning, he says, we've got to go to the mountains. I've got a visa pod. We've got to go see my guru. Now, the term guru has meant for me, in the West, sort of a high-grade teacher. I didn't know what a guru really was. And Bhagwan Das also said, we're going to borrow the Land Rover, which had been left with the sculptor, to go to the mountains. And I said, I don't want to borrow the Land Rover. I've just gotten out of that horrible blue box, and I don't want to get back into it. He left it for this guy. The guy won't want to give it to us, and I don't want the responsibility anyway, and I got very sulky. And I didn't want to go see a guru anyway, and suddenly I wanted to go back to America in the worst way. I thought, what am I doing? I'm following this kid. And we go to the place. He says, we've got to do this. And we go to the place, Borelli, and there is the sculptor. And within a half an hour, the sculptor says, you have to go see a guru. Take the Land Rover. Well, that's interesting. We're in the Land Rover, and he won't let me drive. So I'm sitting there sulking. He won't let me drive, and we got the Land Rover, which I don't want to have, and I'm just in a bad mood. I've stopped smoking hashish a few days before because I'm having all kinds of reactions to it. And I'm just in a state of very, very uptight, negative, paranoid state. And all I want to do is go back to America. And suddenly, I'm following this young kid who wants to drive, and all he wanted me for was to get the Land Rover. And suddenly, the whole paranoid con world comes to my head, and I'm full of it. We go about 80 or 100 miles, and we come to a little tiny temple by the side of a road up in the base of the Himalayas, up into the Himalayas a little. And we stop, and I think we're stopping because a truck's coming by, but when we stop, people surround the car, which they generally do, but they welcome him, and he jumps out. And I can tell something's going to happen, because as we go up into the hills, he's starting to cry with singing songs, and tears are streaming down his face. And I know something's going on, but I don't know what. We stop at this temple, and he jumps out, and he asks where the guru is, and they point up on a hill, and he goes running up this hill. And they're all so delighted he's there. They all love him so much. And I'm following him, and he's 6'7", and I'm running after him, barefoot up this rocky path, and I'm stumbling. By now, my feet are very tough, you know, about a quarter inch of callus. But it's still, his legs are very long, and I'm running, and people are ignoring me, and I'm very bugged, and I don't want to see a guru anyway, and what the hell, and I'm, you know. We go around this hill so that we come to a field which does not face on the road. It's facing into a valley. And there is a little old man sitting with a blanket around him. And around him are about 8 or 9 Hindu people. And it's a beautiful tableau. Clouds, beautiful valley, green valley, a lovely, lovely place, the foothills of the Himalayas. And this fellow, Bhagwan Das, has come up, and he runs to this man, and he throws himself on the ground, full face, called, doing Dunda Pranam, and he's out, so his face is down the ground, full length, and his hands are touching the feet of this man who's sitting, and he's crying, and the man is patting him on the head, and I don't know what's happening, you know. I'm standing on the side and say, well, I'm not going to touch his feet. I have to touch his feet. I'm not replying to him. Every now and then, this man looks up at me, and he twinkled a little. But I'm so uptight that I couldn't care less, you know. Twinkle away, man. Then he looks up to me, and he speaks in Hindi, of which I understand maybe half, and then there is a fellow who's translating all the time, who hangs out with him. He says, you came in a big car? I mean, the one thing I'm really uptight about. So I said, yeah. So he looked at me and he smiled and he said, you give it to me? I started to say, what? And Bhagwan Das looks up, he's lying there, he says, Maharaji, if you want it, you can have it, it's yours. And I said, now wait a minute, you can't give away David's car like that. You know, that is not a car. And I was getting uptight, and this old man is laughing.
The first thing he said before the car was, he pulled Bhagwan Das's hair up and he says, "You have a picture of me?" And Bhagwan Das said, "Yes." He said, "Give it to him." "Well, actually, that's very nice." The old man's going to give me his picture, and, you know, thank you. That's very lovely. That was the level of that experience. Then the car. Then the next thing he says is, "You made much money in America?" So I went through all of my years as a professor and my years as a smuggler and all my different dramas, and I said, "Yeah." He says, "How much do you make?" "Well," I said, "at one time, I mean," and I sort of upped the figure a little bit for, you know, my ego, $25,000. So they all converted that into rupees, which was practically more than the whole economy of India. You know, everybody was terribly awed by this, which was complete bragging on my part. It was phony. I never made $20,000. And he laughed again, and he said, "You'll buy a car like that for me?" And I remember what went through my mind was, I have come out of a family of fundraisers for the United Jewish Appeal at Brandeis, and I have never seen hustling like this. And already he wants the $7,000 vehicle. And I said, "Well, maybe, you know." the whole thing was freaking me so much. And he said, "Take them away, Joe. Take them and give them food." And so we were taken and we were given magnificent food. We were together still. And the sadhus brought us beautiful food and we were told to rest. And then after a while, we were brought back to Maharaji. And he said, "Come here, sit." So I sat down, he looked at me and he said, "You were out of the stars last night." He said, "You were thinking about your mother." Yes. He said, "She died last year." "She got very big in the stomach before she died." Leaned back and closed his eyes and said, "Spleen. Out of spleen. What happened to me at that moment, I can just roughly," because he looked at me in a certain way at that moment, and two things happened which seem simultaneous. They do not seem like cause and effect. The first thing that happened to me was that my mind raced faster and faster to try to get leverage or get a hold on what he had just done. I went through every super CIA paranoia I have ever had, you know, like, who is he? And, like, where is the button he pushes where the file appears? And they brought me here, and, you know, and none of it would gel. I mean, it was just too impossible that this could have happened this way. And the guy I was with didn't know anything, and I was a tourist, and the whole thing was just too far out. And my mind went faster and faster and faster, because up until then, I had two categories for, quote, psychic experiences. One was, they happened to somebody else, and they hadn't happened to me, and they were terribly interesting. We certainly had to keep an open mind about them. That was my social science approach. The other was that it happened to me when I was under the influence of a chemical, and how did I know I wasn't creating the whole thing? Because, in fact, I had taken certain chemicals. The greatest example I have of this is the thing which was called JB318, which I took in a room in Millbrook, and I was sitting on the third floor, and I took it, and it seemed like nothing was happening at all. And in the midst of this, a girl walked in with a pitcher of lemonade, and she said, "Would I like some lemonade?" And I said, "Gee, that would be great." And she poured the lemonade. She was a girl from the community. And she poured, and she kept pouring, and the lemonade went over the side of the glass and fell to the floor, and it went across the floor and up the wall and over the ceiling and down the back of the ceiling and under my pants, which got wet, and it came back up into the glass. And when it touched the glass disappeared, and the water disappeared, and my wetness disappeared, and the girl disappeared. And I turned to Ralph Metzner, and I said, "Ralph, the most extraordinary thing happened to me," and Ralph disappeared. I was afraid to do anything but just sit. Like, whatever this is, it's not nothing. You know, okay, just sit. Don't move, just sit. So I had had experiences where I had seen myself completely create whole environments under psychedelics, and therefore I wasn't eager to interpret these things very quickly, because I, the observer, was under the influence of the psychedelics. This was not the case here, and my mind went faster and faster, and then what happens with a computer when it's set an insoluble problem? Finally, the bell rings, and the red light goes on, and the machine stops. And my mind just gave up. It, like, burned out its circuitry. I needed something to get closure at the rational level, and there wasn't anything. It just wasn't a place I could hide in my head about this. And at the same moment, and this is what I say simultaneously, it did not feel like cause and effect, I felt this extremely violent pain in my chest and a tremendous wrenching feeling, and I started to cry. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried. I wasn't happy, and I wasn't sad. I mean, it was not that kind of crying. The only thing I could say was it felt like I'm home. Like the journey's over, like I'm finished, like it's over. Well, I cried, and they finally sort of spooned me up, and they took me to a temple about 12 miles away to stay, and I stayed overnight. And that night, I had my shoulder bag there, and I was looking for something to make notes about this experience. I was very confused. I didn't yet know what had happened. I felt confused. That was the general feeling. Great feeling of lightness and confusion. And there was a bottle of LSD. I thought, wow, I've met a guy who's going to know. He will definitely know what LSD is. I will have to ask him. That's what I'll do. I'll ask him. Next morning at 8 o'clock, a messenger comes. Maharaji wants to see you immediately. We get in the Land Rover, we drive for 12 miles, and I'm approaching him, and I'm about as wide as this room, this distance from him, and he yells over to me, "Have you got a question?" And I take one look at him, and it's like looking at the sun. I suddenly feel all warm. All I want to do is touch his feet. And I speak, I love you. I don't know. Let me near you. And he's very impatient with all of this nonsense. And he says, "Here's the medicine." I got a translation of this. They said, "Medicine?" And I said, "Medicine? I never thought of LSD as medicine." And somebody said, "He must mean the LSD." LSD? Says, I bring the LSD. So I went to the car, and I got the little bottle of LSD, and I came back, and he, "Let me see." So I poured it out in my hand. He says, "What's that?" And I said, "FTP, and that's Librium, and that's..." A little of everything is sort of like a little traveling. So he says, "Did you siddhis?" I had never heard the word siddhi before. I mean, this is how, where I was at in relation to these concepts. So I asked for translation. Siddhi was translated as power. So I thought he was like a little old man asking for power, like he was losing his vitality. He wanted like vitamin B12, you know. And there was one thing I didn't have, but I felt terribly apologetic.
Travels in India and Beyond, Part 2, The Historic Talk, recorded in 1969, with Ram Dass.
And I said, "Oh, no, I'm sorry. I really felt crushed that I didn't have what he wanted, and I put it back in the bottom." He looked at me, and he holds out his hand. So I put into his hand what's called a white lightning. And this is an LSD pill. And this was a special batch that had been made specially for me for traveling, and it had each pill with 305 micrograms, which was a special number. They were very pure, very good acid. 305, usually you start a man over 60, maybe with 50 to 75 micrograms, very gently, so that you won't upset in case you've got a heart condition, you know, you're very gentle. 300 is, you know, good. Well, pure acid is solid. Well, I put a second pill at 610 micrograms. Well, third pill at 950 micrograms. That is sizable for a first dose, you know. Gotcha.
I just swallowed it. I spooked it out, you know. I mean,
all day long, I'm there, and every now and then he twinkles at me, and nothing happens. Nothing happens.
That was his answer. His answer to my question about what else he did.